Thank you. 25-year-old Korean-born pianist Sunuk Kim making his proms debut with Kirill Karabits and the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra live here at the Royal Albert Hall tonight in Beethoven's Third Piano Concerto. Sunuk Kim was just 18 years old when he won the Leeds International Piano Competition in 2006. And he told me earlier that of all the Beethoven concertos, all of which he knows, that one is absolutely his favourite. Particularly because it comes at the moment that Beethoven really comes into his own and finds his voice, rather than writing in the more classical tradition of Mozart and Haydn. He moves things on. And Sunuk Kim says he finds that incredibly exciting, the energy in the piece. Conductor Kirill Karabits is waving his baton in the air and clapping, as conductors do, on his podium, and the orchestra applauding Sunuk Kim as well and coming to their feet. There's a collection on the BBC Proms website at the moment of all of the piano concertos or works of piano and orchestra that have been performed at the Proms so far. You can watch clips and listen to some of them by going to the website bbc.co.uk/proms. And if you've just tuned into Radio 3, you're listening to the first of two proms tonight. The next one, the late night, is at 10:15, celebrating 40 years of the Tallis Scholars. Pianist Sunuk Kim back on the stage, taking applause by himself next to the piano. His very first performance at the BBC Proms. You can probably hear that's the power of the Prommers in the arena. They stamp their feet. And the performer has no choice but to come on stage again and play an encore. Thank you. pianist Sunuk Kim giving an encore at his proms debut here at the Royal Albert Hall, a Schubert impromptu in E-flat. And in fact, I've just seen Dame Fanny Waterman in the audience of the Leeds International Piano Competition, which he won at the age of 18 back in 2006. Not only a phenomenal concert pianist, also, as we heard Maxime Tourtellier telling us earlier, recent graduate of the Royal Academy of Music's conducting course. And we'll be hearing more from Max later on after the interval of this prom. Well, this year at the proms, all of Tchaikovsky's symphonies are being performed. And the next in the series, the third, the so-called Polish Symphony, comes after the interval. And earlier on this afternoon, Ian Skelly was over at the Royal College of Music with guests to find out more about the symphony, about Tchaikovsky and his world.
Yes, a proms plus event on the work we're about to hear at our prom tonight, the Third Symphony by Tchaikovsky. Well, let's get the views of Marina Frolova-Walker, who was born in Russia and received her musical education in Moscow before heading west. And joining her here at the Royal College of Music is Rosamund Bartlett, a literary and cultural historian. Marina, if I could turn to you first, one of your books is called Russian Music and Nationalism from Glinka to Stalin. Let's brush aside the fact that I didn't know Stalin was a composer, but in terms of the journey from Glinka through to the 20th century, where does Tchaikovsky sit in that story and that narrative of nationalism in Russia?
Yes, I think you're hinting at the fact that Tchaikovsky is not in my book, and indeed he isn't. And there is a reason for that, because Tchaikovsky's position in relation to what we think of as Russian music is paradoxical, because indeed today, if we were to ask anyone in the world, perhaps in Japan or in China or in India, you know, who is the most famous Russian composer, you will probably receive the answer Tchaikovsky. But that wasn't the case in 1908 when Diaghilev started his assault on Paris. And when he presented Tchaikovsky's, it was the finale of the Second Symphony, or the previous symphony, which was one of his most Russian pieces. And the French weren't interested. They still saw Tchaikovsky as a Western composer, a Germanic composer. And in fact, they saw his music as too derivative. And it's not so for now, because what was Russian for them was, in fact, what was written by the Mighty Handful. And that group was trying to monopolize what Russian music meant and create a particular style.
So in 1875, what was their view of Tchaikovsky?
Well, in 1875, they still liked him a lot. Yeah, he was just, his previous symphony was written in close collaboration with the group, and in particular with Balakirev, and followed their principles. Yeah, the finale is these variations of on the Ukrainian theme, which is very much done in the traditions of the Mighty Handful. But at the same time, there was, of course, a rivalry already being established between Moscow and Petersburg, because Tchaikovsky, as he was coming into prominence, he became a direct rival to the Petersburg group and to Rimsky-Korsakov in particular, who was a similar age, yeah, and sort of similar point in their career. So, and in fact, you know, the further you go, the more their paths diverge.
And Rosamund, picking up on that point, as Marina implied there, Moscow was getting going as a city. So in a wider cultural sense, what was happening at the time in 1875?
Well, it was still a really exciting time in Russian culture and society generally at that point. This is the reign of Alexander II, who is known in history as the Tsar Liberator, because he was the Tsar under whom the serfs were emancipated in 1861. And Tchaikovsky had grown up under the reign of the very repressive Nicholas I, who died in 1855, and the death of Nicholas I coincided with the debacle of the Crimean War, which was a complete fiasco for Russia, and showed that Russia really had to reform. And the first thing that had to be reformed, of course, was serfdom. And so this period of the 1860s was the time of the great reforms, and it carried on to a certain degree into the 1870s. But already in 1866, there had been an attempt on Alexander II's life because things didn't go far enough. Nevertheless, this was an incredibly vibrant time in the arts, because Alexander II relaxed the censorship, which had been very, very strict under Nicholas I, and so many new things started happening. There was the foundation of the Russian Musical Society, the brainchild of Anton Rubinstein in 1859 in St. Petersburg. This was the first organization to hold concerts throughout the season. In St. Petersburg. It was followed by one in Moscow. And Rubinstein fought to found a conservatoire in 1862. And in this new climate of new things, it became possible to do that. And Anton Rubinstein was able to persuade Grand Duchess Yelena Pavlovna. In fact, she actually sold her own jewels, I think, to put some money into the enterprise. And it was a way of raising prestige for music and for composers, because in the society of the time, you had to have a rank in society to be someone, and there really wasn't a rank then, of course, for a professional composer, as there was in the arts. And so the foundation of the conservatoire in St. Petersburg, which was then followed by one in Moscow, made it possible and attractive for the first time to actually follow a career of composer. And Tchaikovsky, of course, willingly followed that. He was one of the very first students, so he was able to benefit immediately after graduating from the Imperial School of Jurisprudence. He decided he wanted to have a musical career. And, of course, he was immediately given a job in Moscow in 1866, when he graduated for the new conservatoire there. And in Moscow, there was also a lot of great things going on, because Moscow had always been the industrial powerhouse of Russia. Unlike Petersburg, which was the capital city, it was the city of government, it was the city of army officers and bureaucrats. And Moscow was where the money was made. That's where all the oligarchs of yesteryear made their fortunes. People like Tretyakov, who made a lot of money in the textile industry and were also great philanthropists and founded galleries. So one of the first portraits of Tchaikovsky was at the commission of Tretyakov. So Moscow suddenly started to open up, because they began to build railways at this time, and all the railways converged on Moscow because of its industrial importance. And people after the emancipation who'd been impoverished started moving to the cities, and invariably they started moving to Moscow. So it was a very exciting place for Tchaikovsky to move to, in fact, and the musical life began to perk up. Moscow had always been a sort of backwater, a sort of Balshaya Derevnya, as they called it, a big village, and that began to change very dramatically in the time that Tchaikovsky was living and working at the conservatoire.
And Rubinstein, as you mentioned, created the conservatoire. His brother Nikolai, as well, very influential on Tchaikovsky's career. But it did, Marina, prove to be a testy relationship, didn't it? He was also one of Tchaikovsky's severest critics at the time, as I mentioned at the beginning.
Yes, and actually both Anton and Nikolai, there was a difficult relationship with both of these brothers, who were, of course, both had colossal genius, especially Anton, who was such a wonderful pianist. He was also Tchaikovsky's composition teacher at the conservatoire. And this was actually one of the problematic aspects in Tchaikovsky's relations with Mighty Handful, because they didn't like conservatory education because it was so Germanic. They were thinking of Rubinstein as Germanic composer and Germanic teacher. And therefore, you know, because they were studying forms there, you know, based, say, on Mendelssohn or something like that. So Tchaikovsky as a conservatoire composer was a very different makeup, in a sense. You know, his he studied theory, he studied counterpoint. And the Mighty Handful people, they were really sort of self-taught, taught by Balakirev, sort of hand-to-mouth education. It's very interesting that at this very period, Rimsky-Korsakov also decides to undergo this course of self-study. He's starting writing fugues, yeah, and Tchaikovsky approves of this. Yeah, so in fact, he feels that he doesn't have enough of this technical baggage that Tchaikovsky already had. So that's an interesting thing. Now, of course, with Rubinstein, with the other Rubinstein, Nikolai Rubinstein, who was also a wonderful pianist and a friend of Tchaikovsky, and actually his landlord for during his first Moscow years, for a very long time, he actually lived in Nikolai Rubinstein's flat. And when he wrote this piano concerto, and this was the previous year, he was hoping that Rubinstein would premiere it. And there was this great story about Tchaikovsky showing the concerto to him and getting absolute silence in response. And he was so hurt by this. He says, you know, like you cook a dinner for someone and get no response whatsoever. And when he was trying to get something out of him, Rubinstein just said, you know, it's awful. It's, you know, it's trite. The melodies are trite. The passages are awkward and unplayable, and so on.
But I mean, what fascinates me is that he was practically driven to suicide. If you read the letters, I'm not sure how much that was made up and how much it was true. But
yeah.
But clearly, this symphony is not a gloomy piece, is it? There's a lot of joy in it. Even the funeral march in the first movement is rather jolly.
Well, there are two things here. You know, one thing. You know, when you say Tchaikovsky was driven to suicide, you know, he wrote these very sort of passionate letters, impassioned letters, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, every time that he was really going to do it. It just, you know, he was a sensitive man, and of course this was a great, great offense to him, and he suffered. You shouldn't also, you know, draw direct parallels between what he was feeling and what he was writing at the time, because of course, you know, you can be go through a personal crisis, but you can write joyful music. He's a professional composer. You know, aesthetic emotion is not the same as personal emotion.
So let's just talk a little bit more about the Third Symphony itself. It is known as the Polish. That's the nickname that was given to it, not by Tchaikovsky, but some years later. It's not particularly Polish. You were mentioning the German influence, both of you. Where does it come from? What are the influences?
Well, it's not Polish in that, despite having a polonaise, this is something that was part and parcel of Russian music by that stage. And when we listen to Chopin writing a polonaise, he's definitely writing it with sort of a nationalist impulse. But if you go and listen to Glinka's Life for the Tsar, you'll find a polonaise in there. And in fact, I just mentioned earlier the first assassination attempt on Alexander II in 1866, and Tchaikovsky went to a performance of Life for the Tsar, and when the polonaise came around, it was enough for the audience to get up and start saying, you know, down with the Poles, and they demanded the national anthem to be sung 20 times. And the polonaise was part and parcel linked to the Romanov dynasty. It was linked to the court. It was a stately dance. And in a way, there was something rather aggressive, I think, almost, about Russians using polonaise. It was almost sort of like in your face, you know, we've taken it over. It's not Polish anymore.
And, I mean, Marina, he talks about the second movement being in the German style. And really, the influences, it seems to me, are very strong from Schumann.
Yes, that's true. When Tchaikovsky was really only trying to find his proper symphonic route, so to speak, and one of his models was Robert Schumann. And in fact, Robert Schumann's symphonies were incredibly popular in Russia at the time, they were considered, you know, a model of symphonic work. So there are a lot of correspondences there. There's something else as well, which I think I might have discovered, but I might be wrong about that. The second movement, yeah, is called Alla Tedesca, so in the German manner. And I found a possible model for it, which is in Robert Folkman, who was a friend of Schumann. Now we don't know who he was, but actually at the time, his first symphony was played in Russia quite a lot. And Tchaikovsky, you know, doubtless knew it. So it's actually a very similar waltz in the same key. You know, there are quite a lot of similarities. And that might explain why a waltz, and it is really a waltz, is called Alle Tedesco because it comes from a German source.
And, of course, the theatre was getting going too in Moscow. And I think I'm right in saying that as he was writing this symphony, certainly Swan Lake was bubbling away in his mind. So was theatre becoming a very important part of Moscow life?
Very much so. It was part of life in St. Petersburg too, of course, where he'd been educated. And it's striking that two of the events which made a huge impression on him when he first moved to St. Petersburg from the provinces, he was born out towards the Urals, of course. He moved to St. Petersburg to be educated when he was 10, and he went to a performance of Glinka's Life for the Tsar, and he also went to a performance of Giselle, and both were huge importance in his life. They also had a branch of the Imperial Theatres, of course, in Moscow, although the standard of performance wasn't quite as high, and the Imperial Italian Opera had its main base in St. Petersburg. So Tchaikovsky saw as much as he could, and actually he was a great supporter of the Russian opera that was available at the time, which wasn't very much. And of course, these are all new genres. You know, very little symphonies had been written before Tchaikovsky started writing them. Rimsky-Korsakov was writing, Baradin was writing, Balakirev wrote a little bit of symphonic music, but this was a new genre, and the same is true of opera. So Tchaikovsky was going to the opera and beginning to contribute, of course, to its repertoire as well. Certainly, he loved the theatre, and you can sort of hear the dance in this symphony in particular. You can just feel him just launching off to writing for dancers. And of course, he would totally transform ballet as a genre, because it was such a sort of hack thing to do to be a composer for the ballet until Tchaikovsky. He was a great genius in that respect.
If I may, just to continue a little bit about the ballet, yeah, because it's interesting because he got a commission for the Swan Lake at the beginning of the summer of 1875, and he didn't start composing it until August, but he started composing the Third Symphony, and you can imagine that his mind was already in the balletic frame, because all of these things, like a march, a waltz, a kind of Russian dance that you also hear in the first movement, a Polonaise, of course, you know, they're all very much connected to the music of the Swan Lake. And even if you go further to the Sleeping Beauty, there is an apotheosis there, which is very similar to the apotheosis in the final movement of the symphony. So it's all very danceable. And when this symphony was played, I think it was the 7th of November, 1875, it did have a good response. Tchaikovsky was slightly lukewarm about it. I think he said, well, they're not really good scenes there, you know, although, you know, I like this movement, not like that. He was very self-critical, and I think a lot of people would consider this symphony atypical for Tchaikovsky, just because he wrote another three wonderful symphonies after that, you know, and this eclipsed the third a little bit.
It certainly helped to put him on the map, Rosamund, and he even came into the orbit of Planet Tolstoy, I gather.
Well, he did, actually. This is such an interesting period for Tchaikovsky. He's on the cusp of becoming not just a famous Russian composer, but a famous composer outside his country as well. And it's striking that someone like Tolstoy, who was sitting in Yasna Polyana, he was busy writing Anna Karenina at this time, and he didn't have that much interest, really, in contemporary music. He was almost totally unaware of what Mussorgsky was doing, for example, even though it was quite sort of similar to his own aesthetics. But Tolstoy demanded to meet Tchaikovsky, which is very unusual. He came to Moscow one day, and basically sort of refused to go away from the conservatoire until he was introduced to the composer. And Tchaikovsky was a very shy and retiring person. This comes across again and again in his letters. And it wasn't just because he was a little bit tortured by the fact that he was gay and it wasn't easy to be gay in pre-revolutionary Russia. It's because he was just a very private person and he thought, ooh, I've got to meet this really famous writer. But he couldn't get out of it. And Tolstoy almost sort of pinned him against a wall and started haranguing him about what a bad composer Beethoven was. And that was so offensive to Tchaikovsky. I mean, they had nicer conversations after that, but Tolstoy, I think he fancies himself as a specialist. He even wanted to share with Tchaikovsky some Russian folk songs, which Tchaikovsky immediately saw weren't very interesting, in fact. And he was a very sentimental man, so he loved the folk song in the first string quartet, which was performed specially for him. So Tchaikovsky had a few conversations with him, and he had many opportunities actually to meet Turgenev in Paris, but sort of shrank from it. And the only other really interesting writer whom he had some contact with was Chekhov, actually. And actually, he went out of his way to meet Chekhov, who, like himself, was quite a sort of shy and modest person. And they had a wonderful brief friendship, in fact, and that was a sort of mutual admiration society.
Well, there we must draw it to a close. May I just thank both of our guests for their time this evening, Marina Frolova-Walker and Rosamund Bartlett. Thank you very much.
That was Ian Skelly with this afternoon's Proms Plus event, looking at Tchaikovsky and his world, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall in the Royal College of Music's Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall. Well, welcome back to the Albert Hall. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. Tonight's concert continues now with Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony. I'm still joined by Maxime Tourtellier. Max, you are the young associate conductor of the orchestra. Let's talk a little bit about this piece. Kirill Karabits was telling me earlier that one of the exciting things about Tchaikovsky's Third is that it's the one that not everyone believes is particularly great or has that many authoritative recordings of it that everyone is, you know, really, really attached to.
Yes.
For him, that's a really exciting thing.
Well, I can understand why. I think he's right. Even actually when it was premiered, I think it was the least warmly received of the six symphonies, and somehow it has kept this sort of status up to this day, which in a way gives Kirill and the orchestra a great card to play, a great asset, because they're going to try and show how much it's worth all the other ones, especially 4, 5, and 6. I think you will find in each of the five, not four but five movements, bits that will, if you're familiar with Tchaikovsky, that will remind you, oh, this reminds me of a place in the Fourth Symphony or in the Piano Concerto. And I bet if you listen carefully to the fourth movement, you'll feel transported to some of his ballet music, especially the Nutcracker. So it's got all the good bits, and it's there for us to enjoy.
And you, in your work with Bournemouth, you were saying earlier, you work with Kirill Karabits. There was a really funny moment earlier on where Marin Alsop, previous principal conductor,
yes,
of the orchestra,
of course,
who's at the Proms on Saturday, was here listening to a bit of the rehearsal, and she and Kirill were talking on stage afterwards, and he said, you know, that's the first time we've ever met, because we've just never managed to be in a room together. I mean, conductors don't really hang out together, do they?
No, I think it's a very solitary profession, and even I, as the conductor in association, I get to see Kirill during rehearsals and during the breaks, but it goes incredibly fast, and we rarely have time to have the odd drink or so, because, I mean, especially his fault, because he's got such a busy schedule.
Well, Kirill Karabits is going to conduct the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra tonight, making his way on stage to the Royal Albert Hall. He's just coming from his dressing room through the Bull Run and out onto the stage. My thanks to Max Tourtellier for joining me tonight. Let's hear Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony, the so-called Polish Symphony. The Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Karabits.
Thank you.